It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a new documentary on America's first Somali-American lawmaker. First, it's time for our weekly look at some of the biggest stories in national politics. Last night, several states held primary elections for U.S. Senate and House seats, as well as a governor's race. President Trump wants Congress to reverse spending from the omnibus bill passed in March, and Robert Mueller's investigation has gotten some pushback in federal courts. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Were you watching those primary election results last night in West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, and North Carolina? What did you take away, if so? And as the president rolls out a proposal to take out $15 billion from that spending bill, do you think there are places that cuts should be made? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll also be talking about growing calls for marijuana legalization in the country. What do you think of that idea? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Neuhauser joins us now. He's a staff correspondent for the National Journal. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on again.
Let's start with those primary elections, Dan. I think the one people were watching the most was this Republican U.S. Senate primary in West Virginia. Republicans, a lot of national Republicans, relieved by what happened and what didn't happen there. Can you talk us through that one?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the top line headline coming out of this primary election wasn't even who won. It was who didn't win. Don Blankenship, the former CEO of Massey Energy, is an oil company. He spent a year in federal prison after an explosion at one of his mines killed 29 men. And the courts found that he had violated safety laws. Well, he is back with a vengeance. He spent a lot of his own personal fortune trying to win this Senate race, and it turned pretty ugly in the end with Blankenship running ads attacking Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell because his wife, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, is a Chinese American, and they were very racially tinged ads. It did not go over well. He ended up losing to great sighs of relief from the political Republican establishment here in D.C. Democrats, they would have loved to run against a guy like that. It would have been Todd Akin all over again. They would have had a good chance, like what happened down in Alabama with Roy Moore. But alas, they have to run against Patrick Morrissey, who, you know, I should say he's not exactly Mr. Establishment. I mean, he has an endorsement of Ted Cruz. But if you're, you know, if you're putting these things on a sliding scale, he's better for Republicans than Don Blankenship.
There's a lot going on here. Republicans are hoping to keep their Senate majority. They have a narrow majority. The map looks good for them. Democrats are defending a lot more seats than Republicans are. And this looks like, in some ways, a good shot for a Republican takeaway from a currently held Democratic seat. Joe Manchin holding that seat right now. But this is a state that Donald Trump, as a candidate, won big in the presidential election. This not having Blankenship there, Republicans think, boosts their chances for a takeaway here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, West Virginia is in many ways still a Democratic state, but the Democrats are not what you would find in, say, Connecticut or California. I mean, these are, you know, working class sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters of coal miners. You know, the coal runs deep in that state. And even a lot of these Democrats supported Trump. They support his efforts to bring back coal, or at least his what he says about bringing back coal. So Manchin, who has tried to toe the line, has tried to be a centrist as you can be as a Democrat in D.C. these days. He remains vulnerable just because of the D next to his name.
There's questions about how close Republican candidates are going to run when it comes to Donald Trump, how much they're going to bring up his name. There's also, it seems like, a growing movement to distance candidates for the Senate from their own Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. I mean, Blankenship was an extreme example with his ads talking about cocaine Mitch. There's a tenuous thread there. But a lot of candidates are maybe not so wild about Mitch McConnell.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be surprised about that. I mean, look at how Donald Trump won to begin with. He was the outsider candidate. He was the guy who was not part of the political establishment, and he took out a whole field of candidates, any of whom, you know, were portrayed as more qualified than Trump, simply by running against them or running against that establishment. Well, who represents the establishment more than Mitch McConnell? he's the guy. So, of course, they're going to run against him. And, you know, look no further than, for instance, the Indiana Senate race, where two Republican congressmen were running, and another guy who was, of course, a former politician in the state, but who hadn't been in politics for a few years and who was, you know, a self-funder, very wealthy, Mike Braun. He swooped in and ran as sort of the anti-establishment guy, and maybe part of the fact that he was able to win could be attributed to the fact that the other two guys had rep next to their names, and he didn't.
Talking to Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal in our weekly roundup of national politics. Dan, I want to move to the Democratic race, the Democratic primary, that I think was the most watched on the Democratic side in the country, that the race for governor of Ohio. We had this Democratic primary, Richard Cordray, former head of that Consumer Protection Bureau that's been under attack, definitely by Republicans, and then former U.S. Representative, a familiar name, Dennis Kucinich. How did this one play out? Was this seen as like an establishment versus further left kind of race?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was maybe even more sort of progressive and super progressive. I mean, Dennis Kucinich has always been on the cutting edge of progressivism. If you look at his platform in the 2000s when he ran for president, a lot of the stuff that he had on the list was, it seemed, pretty out there, and yet today it's mainstream. You know, the anti-war stuff, his financial message. He went at Cordray on guns, actually, because when Cordray was running statewide, he touted his positive record with regards to the NRA. But Kucinich also said that, you know, Cordray was the establishment guy, that he wasn't progressive enough. That didn't quite test out with Ohio Democrats. Cordray, after all, was endorsed by Elizabeth Warren, who is a stalwart progressive. Kucinich is a sort of, you know, he's been out of the game for a while. Some people think he's maybe a little washed up, and he was just trying to, you know, reclaim some of the power that he used to have. Cordray ran away with this one pretty handily. And it'll be an interesting one for Democrats, who often complain that they don't get to talk about economics enough. Well, who better to do that than Cordray, the former head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? He can talk about his efforts that have been stymied by Republicans to try to help what he says is the little guy, everyday Americans. So we'll see how that plays out in the general against the Attorney General Mike DeWine.
Lots more primaries to watch between now and Election Day. I want to move on to the nation's capital now. Donald Trump, President Trump, unveiled a rescission package, meaning we passed this omnibus spending bill a while back. We and the president in particular not happy about it and looking to make some cuts, go back and make some cuts to that. What kind of rollbacks are we seeing in this so-called rescission package?
Well, actually, let me just correct you there. This rescission package has nothing to do with the omnibus bill.
Oh, it doesn't. Okay, I'm sorry.
So they had mentioned earlier this year that they want to release a rescission package dealing with the omnibus. Hmm. Senate Republicans told them, look, we just can't do that. Mitch McConnell's looking ahead, and he's thinking, I'm going to have to pass another omnibus probably this year, and every time an omnibus passes, I need Democratic votes. How can I go look Chuck Schumer in the eye and say, hey, I need your vote on this, if he knows I'm just going to go turn around and cut funding after we passed it? So he's thinking, this is a deal breaker. I can't pass something one day with Democrats and tell them it's going to be a certain way and then, you know, turn my back on them the next week and expect them to be there for me again a week later after that. So as a, I guess, sort of a soft compromise, this rescission package is going to target $15 billion from old spending accounts.
Ah,
so this
okay.
is essentially money that has been appropriated, but the authorization has expired. So, say like $5 billion from the Children's Health Insurance Program, a $2 billion contingency fund, which the administration says is unnecessary. $800 million from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, and so on and so forth. Another $100 million from Hurricane Sandy relief, which requires local communities to match the dollars. So that's kind of already gone and passed. It's not going to have a big impact on the deficit. This is money that may or may not have been spent at all. And when we're talking about $1.3 trillion budget and, you know, a deficit about the same, $15 billion is really a drop in the bucket. But I think this is more of the administration testing the waters. Okay, what can we do? Can we get Democrats on board with some of this? How far can we push on rescissions? And, you know, if they do this, they said later in the year they're going to try to get an omnibus targeted rescissions package out as well.
Is there an appetite in the House and especially the Senate to do something like this?
Certainly there is an appetite in the House. Republicans there, I would guess, would pass this pretty handily. In the Senate, it's really tough. You know, John McCain, who we're going to talk about later in the show, is not in the Senate. It's not likely that he will return. So that puts the Republican majority, you know, straight down the line at 50. And if they need 51 votes, I mean, they can't afford to lose even one person. And, you know, a lot of those senators, they run statewide. Even in Republican districts, the children's health insurance program to them, that's a good thing that they can run on, something they can really hang their hat on. And even if this rescissions package will not really have that much of an impact, the political ads write themselves. You know, they voted to cut $7 billion from the children's health insurance program for no reason, and Democrats are already testing out that message, and especially when Republicans are having a, you know, Sisyphean enough feet trying to win re-election this year, something like this is not really what they want to deal with.
Talking to Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent at the National Journal, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. After two judges questioned whether special counsel Robert Mueller is overreaching his mandate, do you agree? Is the investigation going too far? We'll also talk about legalizing marijuana. Dan has written about this. Is this something that you want to see your local candidate run on, maybe a political party run on? Should Democrats back the idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Dan Neuhauser of the National Journal. We're looking into some of the week's top political news. Still to talk about Mueller, marijuana, and the McCain memoirs. Dan, let's start with Robert Mueller's investigation of the Paul Manafort efforts going on here. And we heard from a couple judges in federal courts, at least raising questions about whether Mueller was exceeding what he was supposed to do. What did we hear?
Yeah, that's right. Judge T.S. Ellis in Virginia expressed some skepticism. Now, this is the Paul Manafort case, and when the prosecutors tried to bring up Manafort's alleged ties to Ukraine from 2005 and around that time, the judge was quite skeptical. He said, "Okay, hold on a sec. How does that relate to the charge of the special prosecutor? How does this have anything to do with what the special prosecutor should have any say in?" And the judge essentially accused the prosecutors of trying to try these cases only to put pressure on Manafort to flip and to testify against Trump or somebody higher on the food chain. It was really an interesting moment in court and showing that Mueller's prosecution and his efforts in this case are not going to be easy. It's going to be challenged. I don't know where that's going to go eventually, whether the challenge from the court was maybe more rhetorical in nature, maybe more trying to prove a point. It didn't seem like at the end of the day they're actually going to, you know, throw this case out or anything like that, but they were raising questions.
And the president... President was happy to hear those questions. Speaking at the NRA convention earlier this week, he read out loud from an article about this.
Judge T.S. Ellis, who is really something very special, I hear from many standpoints, he's a respected person, suggested the charges before the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia were just part of the Mueller team's designs to pressure Mr. Manafort into giving up information on President Donald Trump or others in the campaign. I've been saying that for a long time. It's a witch hunt.
So whatever this means, Dan, legally, it is definitely entering the court of public opinion, these questions from the judge.
Yeah, absolutely. Democrats have slammed the judge. Republicans have praised him. You know, a pretty predictable political turn of events. For something that may really be a drop in the bucket as far as really the importance of this case.
I want to bring on a caller now. Catherine is with us in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
My feeling is that Mr. Mueller should be able to continue his investigation void of this competition, as you have indicated, of the court of public opinion. if we truly believe in our democracy, we need to let our government work. And I feel like from the beginning of the Trump campaign into his administration, we all have been lulled to sleep somewhat by what I would describe as the music man syndrome. We're not focused on the truth. And that should be what the focus is. And even with the judge asking for what their authorization is, that doesn't take away the authority of Mueller to do a thorough investigation, let the chips fall where they may, whether he gets to have somebody turn against the president, so be it. That is the way our legal system works.
Catherine, thanks for the call. And part of the charge for Mueller was the Russia probe, possible cooperation between Trump's campaign and outside forces, and whatever may come up during the investigation, which is pretty broad, Dan, but it looks like that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, a federal judge doesn't really have the right to tell the Department of Justice who to try and how and, you know, whether or not this and that is the right way to do it. I think he was just raising some questions. The judge, you know, he may not like it, but you know, he doesn't have the right to tell the Justice Department which prosecutor to assign to which case. So, you know, even if he's right, and he can push aggressively against him, it didn't seem as if there was anything untoward happening from Manafort.
Thanks for that call.
From Mueller,
gotcha. Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal about some of the top stories in national politics. I want to move on to something you've been writing about, Dan, the issue of marijuana legalization, a big change in public opinion and in political opinion. What are you seeing changing?
Well, yeah, I kind of came onto the subject because Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader right now, who has a real chance of becoming the Senate Majority Leader, for the first time, and this is he's a pretty, you know, anti-drug, pro-drug war kind of guy, an old-school legislator who went along with a lot of those Say No to Drugs ads, he endorsed the decriminalization of marijuana bill. He said he's evolved on the issue, that he now sees that that there's been too many young men, minorities, put into jail over the years because of this, that it actually could have a medicinal purpose, and that it should be left to the states to regulate it however they like without federal intervention. So that puts him in line with Nancy Pelosi, who has a pretty good chance of becoming the Speaker of the House if Democrats win the House this year. And, that just has it's got to make you think that if Democrats take the House, are they going to do something on the federal level about marijuana? I asked around, and it turns out that for a lot of progressives, well, that's decriminalization isn't quite enough. The Congressional Black Caucus, for instance, who represent a lot of these communities that have been ravaged by the drug war, a lot of young men in jail, they want to not just decriminalize marijuana. They want to expunge records. They want to release people from prison. They want to help people who were put in jail for marijuana get into the legal marijuana industry. So there's a real push there from progressives to go further than just what sort of the safe tactics that leadership have pursued, the sort of a one-size-fits-all federal policy that lets the states do whatever they want.
Dan, not that long ago, a major politician supporting marijuana legalization, it wouldn't have happened. I think you instantly would have put yourself in the fringe if you lobbied for that, say, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. What's going on in public opinion that's changing that?
Well, I just think people are waking up to the fact that marijuana is not this harmful drug that the federal government for so long has portrayed it as. One of the things that that Chuck Schumer and almost every other Democrat agrees with now is taking it off of the DEA's Schedule I classification, which basically puts marijuana on the same level as cocaine, methamphetamines, opioids. Even now, and this came as quite a surprise, former Speaker John Boehner joined the board of a legal marijuana company, and he says that he has come to believe that this could help solve the opioid crisis, particularly among veterans. So there's a lot of things going on here. First of all, money. Money talks. There's the states that have legalized. They have made a whole lot of money, a lot of that going towards education and whatever else they want to spend it on. The second thing is now that it's being tested, and Chuck Schumer hinted on at this on his interview, he looked at the evidence coming out of the states where it's been legalized, and none of the bad things that people predicted would happen are happening. There's not younger people smoking marijuana. There's not an increase in drug use and in other kinds of drug use. So that kind of undercuts the argument that it's a gateway drug. There haven't been more car accidents, and all the way down the line, none of those things have really panned out. So what he and other people are saying is, hey, what's the harm?
And Dan, I want to spend our last couple of minutes, Senator John McCain, his memoir, The Restless Wave, coming out later this month, in very ill health himself right now. We've seen some excerpts from his memoir. What's striking you about what we're hearing from that book?
Well, if I can harken back to a Obama versus McCain era SNL phrase, he's being very mavericky. He's intent, it seems, on going out as he came in as the maverick of the Senate. He has essentially said he regrets picking Sarah Palin, and it's not for some of the reasons that liberals might want him to say. He still thinks that she's good. She had a big effect on the population, but he wishes that he picked Joe Lieberman. He wishes he said it was maybe the public spotlight was too much too soon for Palin, and he regrets that. So you know, that was an interesting kind of a look back. Of course, the biggest headline came out of the excerpts of his book coming out was that he doesn't want Donald Trump at his funeral. That's angered some of his colleagues, but, you know, it's his funeral, and I guess he has the right to have whoever he wants there. And then finally, he talked about campaign finance and warned against the influence of dark money. And that's nothing new from Senator John McCain. Of course, his name is on the McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill that tried to make a soft money a little bit harder in politics. You know, especially in this era when Mitch McConnell, for instance, has been a leader in trying to keep any kind of campaign finance from becoming law, McCain, one of his top senior members in the Senate, coming out against that, it really does seem noteworthy.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us again.
All right, thank you.
That's Dan Neuhauser, staff correspondent at the National Journal, with us for a weekly look at the news from Washington. Ilhan Omar was elected 2 years ago to the Minnesota House of Representatives. It was an unlikely victory in some ways, and on election night, she became the first Somali-American lawmaker in the country. Here she is talking to voters at a bookstore in Minneapolis during the campaign.
What happens in a lot of marginalized communities is that we think, I don't have a voice. This just has been the thing. I'm not going to be able to make any change, so why bother?
Now a new documentary called Time for Ilhan tells Omar's story. Nora Shapiro is the director of the documentary. Nora, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, what led you to tell Ilhan's story?
You know, I have been interested for a long time in my previous work in stories about new Americans and contemporary life in America, and in particular in my home in Minnesota. And I had also long been fascinated with the Somali American community in Minneapolis. It's certainly the largest Somali community in the United States and possibly outside of Somalia. And I had been looking for a time and was fortunate enough to be introduced to Ilhan Omar almost at the start of her campaign in back at the end of 2015. And I knew, I would say almost instantaneously, that A, Ilhan was a remarkable individual, but B, this was an important story to document. I had little idea at the time how much bigger that story would end up becoming and resonating, but I knew that it was a story that was going to allow me to turn a lens on a lot of issues that are really pressing in America today.
Can you tell a little bit of Ilhan Omar's story, where she came from and how she ended up making this decision to go into politics?
Sure. So in a nutshell, Ilhan grew up in Somalia and had actually a really lovely life there until war broke out, and she, like many other people, were forced into refugee status, and she ended up fleeing the country with her family. She was the youngest in a large family, and they spent about 4 years in a refugee camp in Kenya before they were able to finally end up immigrating to the United States. And she came to this country as a young girl and ended up growing up here in Minneapolis with her family.
And she came into the country not speaking any English, as we just heard in that clip. She speaks it now, but she was starting from nothing as far as the English language, knowing what was going on in the United States, anything, right?
That's right. She tells us a funny story where she says she knew only three words, hello and shut up, and those three words didn't make her a lot of friends. But, yeah, so she, you know, she started not speaking the language, being black, being Muslim, and that was the context in which she grew up in America.
Now, there you are. You're making this documentary, following around her campaign, kind of looking over her shoulder in a way. What were you seeing? What kind of reactions were you seeing from people in this very Democratic part of Minnesota?
What I was seeing, and increasingly so over the course of her campaign. Well, certainly, I'll start with what I was seeing on the inside. On the inside, what I was seeing was an unbelievable groundswell and enthusiasm of young people coming out to get involved in her campaign and for a campaign that was being run differently. And it was young people, people of color, other new Americans, many people who have not been involved in the political process and at those levels, and who have not necessarily felt welcomed. So that was what we were seeing on the inside. Externally, what we were seeing, and increasingly so as the campaign built and went on, was people really responding and resonating, both to Ilhan herself and her campaign, but also the way in which they were conducting the campaign and what they were campaigning about. There was, however, a split, and this is part of what makes good drama and made such an interesting story to document and hopefully an interesting film to watch. This was a three-way race. She was fighting not only a 43-year incumbent, who was a white woman, a feminist trailblazer in her day, in her own right, and I think the longest serving legislator of either gender at the time in the nation. And then also a Somali male from the same community. And so there were interesting dynamics playing out in that situation.
And you've mentioned a couple times she ran a different kind of campaign. What do you mean by that?
Well, she ran a campaign of inclusiveness and of listening and of reaching out, like I mentioned before, to people who have not been activated, certainly in that district, and one could extrapolate and argue at a much larger level, statewide and nationwide. So she reached out across, you know, she talked about being someone who happened to be Somali and happened to be Muslim, but as a community activist who was looking to represent issues and the people in the district. So she reached out into her Somali community, but she also reached out into the long-term residents in that community. And she also, in a key move, reached out to the young people and the student vote that had been, their participation numbers had been abysmal previously, and largely because nobody had really ever gone and activated and asked those people to get involved. So I think the numbers were something, I may have this wrong, but something like 123. And this is in a district with a gigantic state university, one of the largest in the country, and another college right within this small district. And citizens, those young people, were not feeling like they were being listened to or represented.
Nora Shapiro is with us, filmmaker, director of the new documentary Time for Ilhan, about the nation's first Somali-American lawmaker in Minnesota. Nora, going beyond Ilhan a little bit, it seems like if there's a wider message, it's that people who people can come up with a lot of reasons why they're not the political type, the sort of person who'd run for office. Ilhan had many of those: Somali immigrant, Muslim, black, mom, young, you mentioned. But maybe people should start to rethink those reasons why they couldn't run.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, one of the best ways to put it, and Ilhan herself has very recently in social media articulated this at from a training that she just participated in at the United States of Women. It's this whole idea of turning on its head what some people might look at as barriers and actually turning those into assets. That certainly was the case with what she did in her campaign. And I think there's a really strong and resonating message there. And I think that's a message that you're seeing borne out, a principle you're seeing borne out across the country. People are talking about a wave of women running for office, a wave of black women running for office, a wave of other non-traditional or quote-unquote outsider candidates. Because the argument is, and the reality is that we have a much stronger democracy when it's a democracy that truly is representative. And people are hungry for that.
And Nora, the documentary, I believe, is complete. I had, a complete version to watch. Is that going on the road next? How are people going to be able to see it?
Yeah, so we literally are just catching our breath still. We just are back and had our world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival at the end of last month. And then just after that, went on to have its international premiere at the Hot Docs International Film Festival, which is the largest documentary festival in North America. From there, we go on and begin what we hope is a really healthy festival run. We've got several other festivals that are already public and a bunch of other ones that I can't quite say yet, but people should stay tuned. We are in conversations with a number of different potential broadcast platforms, and as well as conversations about distribution. And in addition to all of that, and this relates to your earlier question about this moment and the message of the film, we actually have a really ambitious and aggressive dream for this film in the shape of its impact and outreach campaign. It's our hope to take the film across the country and even beyond and do maybe 1,000 screenings in colleges and universities and grassroots organizations and organizations working with women and organizations working with new Americans to really inspire people to see the film and then take action, whether that be running for office themselves, whether that be getting involved and working in a campaign on behalf of one of these candidates, or at a minimum, simply showing up and becoming active, whether that's registering to vote or, going out and doing a door knocking or getting involved in local government or local organizations to get more people thinking of themselves as being in the game and getting a seat at the table and getting an important seat at the table.
Nora, thanks for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Nora Shapiro, director of the new documentary Time for Ilhan. She was with us to talk about the documentary and the story of Ilhan Omar, the country's first Somali-American lawmaker. Now it's National Travel and Tourism Week, and Wisconsin's tourism industry has shown strong growth over the last few years. A recent press release from Governor Walker's office says that tourism created 23,000 new jobs since 2011 and contributed $20.6 billion to the state's economy in 2017. As the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, Stephanie Klett spends a lot of her time traveling the state to promote Wisconsin tourism and to support people working in the industry. Secretary Klett, welcome back to the show.
Rob, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, can you talk about the growth in tourism spending here in Wisconsin over the last bunch of years?
Well, it's been incredible, and that's because we have such a great product. I started in 2011, so we've been tracking those numbers since then, and we are up nearly 40% from then. We started at about $14.8 billion in 2011, And our new numbers are out for 2017, and it came in a total of $20.6 billion in economic impact for Wisconsin. So we're just really thrilled because we have, you know, 72 counties, 11 sovereign nations. It's the seventh year in a row of increases in visitor spending. And, you know, the tourism industry just shows this stable long-term growth. You know, 195,000 people are employed because of tourism. Last year, I think this is a number that really blew all of us away, even at the Department of Tourism, there were 110 million visits to our state. So that's an increase of almost 20% since 2011, when we had about 92.5 million visits 7 years ago. So the one last thing I just have to say that I'm so proud of is that we have all these tourism businesses, and over 60% are small businesses, meaning 50 employees or less. But, you know, they're creating all these jobs. They're welcoming visitors to our state. So in state and local taxes, $1.5 billion was paid. So, you know, that goes for everything from roads to fire and police protection. And so you talk about a win-win. And a statistic that I think is great is that, you know, it would take each household an extra $660 to maintain existing services that, you know, that they get because of tourism. So it really is a win-win for our state. People have an incredible experience from around the world in our state. We know when they have a great time, they're coming back, and it's great for the economy as well.
Well, that's been growing along with a national recovery from the Great Recession that was wrapping up around the beginning of that time period. How do we compare to other states? Are we rebounding? Are we growing faster than maybe our neighbors or other states when it comes to tourism spending?
Yeah, well, it depends where you're talking about. Now, you know, because like California and Florida, Nevada, obviously, you know, their rates are pretty impressive. But no, in the Midwest, especially in the upper Midwest, our state is really crushing it, you know, and it's, I'm just so proud of the product and of, you know, all the great convention and visitors bureaus and chambers in the state. Some of them are so big, some of them are so small, but they're doing innovative things and they're really focusing on a great product and customer service. And so, you know, we got away from all those slogans and we really branded our state as the fun state. And so every community can grab onto that, and I just think it's paying off. You know, you'll see things, you know, kind of, I don't want to say the same old, but, you know, in Illinois, it's mile after magnificent mile, and then we've got pure Michigan, and then we've got only in Minnesota. Well, our brand is so simple. It's fun. You know, we got away from all those slogans, and so all 72 counties and our tribal nations can grab onto that brand of fun, and we're winning and ranked number one in fun, family friendliness, affordability, and a welcoming, worry-free atmosphere when compared to our Midwest competitors. And of course, that's Minnesota and Illinois and Iowa, Indiana, Missouri, Michigan. And so we're also ranked number one for beautiful scenery, fall colors, agritourism, great microbreweries, wineries, and Native American culture. So we're really starting to differentiate ourselves as well in that area.
Talking to Stephanie Klett, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, looking at growing tourism numbers in terms of dollars and visits here in the state. Yeah, talking about sending that message about Wisconsin. There are some new ads out. Here's one of the new Wisconsin tourism ads.
This is Gemulekite, the spirit of Wisconsin. Eddie feels it. Kim embraces it. Even brother and sister get along. Friendship, warmth, and good cheer. That's Gemulekite. And that's Wisconsin.
As you said, friendliness, one of the things we're rated well in, trying to send that message there.
You know what? I'm so glad you played that. Thank you. And for people who haven't seen it yet and just heard it, the yodeler you hear at the beginning is a guy named Tony Zrogan. He owns the Alpendel Cheese Store in Monroe. And something we've been doing different is our last few commercials, 99% of the people in the commercials are real Wisconsinites. you know, just normal folks. Because, well, again, in growing tourism, we got away from everybody being perfect. Everybody being 21 years old, and God bless you if you're 21 out there and listening, and a size 6. We've got people of all ages, all colors, all backgrounds, and that's because everyone's welcome. And so Gemütlichkeit is the name of that commercial, and Gemütlichkeit is a German word, and it means welcoming and that spirit of friendship, warmth, and good cheer. And that's exactly what you feel when you come to Wisconsin. In fact, we even have communities like the city of Jefferson that celebrates with Gemütlichkeit Day. And, of course, with kind of the whole German feel, you know, we have some of the best Oktoberfest celebrations outside of Munich, Germany, especially in La Crosse. They were rated top 10, Oktoberfest celebrations in the world. And so it was just another avenue that we took. And one other, our other new ad for this season I'm really proud of because we're approaching something totally new with Barrier Free. And this is a commercial about Wisconsin and how great it is. But the star of it is a man named Matt Scott, who's a gold medalist, a Paralympic athlete for wheelchair basketball. He led UW-Whitewater to 3 national wheelchair basketball championships. Now, he was born and raised in Michigan. He plays ball for Team USA in Europe, but he vacations in Wisconsin. So I loved having our arch nemesis of pure Michigan, you know, stealing a Michigan resident who loves vacationing here, star in our commercial.
I want to bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Stephanie. I was just wondering, is there any figures on how much money tourist money comes in from people in Wisconsin going to other places in Wisconsin compared to how much people bring in from out of state?
Oh, interesting. I was wondering that too, Dennis. Thanks for that call, Stephanie.
And that's a great question. We know that 50% of our visitors are from Wisconsin. So a significant portion of that money is coming in state. And that's why we spend a lot of advertising dollars in Wisconsin. 25% of it is coming from Chicago to really upper Illinois. And then the rest is divided between, you know, the upper Midwest, national and international. But about 50% of our travel expenditures, close to 50%, are from in-state. And so that's a great market. And it also lets us know, you know, people would be like, I'm getting out of here if it wasn't a great product. And for me, I would never have to leave the state except in a really long winter. And I'd have a great time all the time. But that's a great question.
Dennis, thanks for the call. I know a lot of a big percentage of the tourism done in Wisconsin is done by Stephanie Klett. Very briefly, Secretary Klett, what are your next couple stops?
I am actually, you have the Yodler. I am off to Monroe and New Glarus. Those are my next two steps. And I'll be meeting and taking a tour of the Chalet Cheese Company and meeting at Baumgartner's. I am your reigning Limburger queen, and they've made me that in perpetuity now. And I think it's because, I like to say it's because I'm so good, but I think it's no one else wants a job. And so those are my next two stops. And just coming in from Chautauqua and the Milwaukee County Zoo and Wausau and the Lee Yaffe Woodson Art Museum and a new Titletown District in Green Bay.
You've been everywhere. Secretary Klett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much.
We've been talking to Stephanie Klett. She's the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism. We talked with her about the economic impact of the state's tourism industry. Let us know where you are touring in Wisconsin over the next couple of weeks. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Let us know where you're headed.